From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 2015 at Tehran University, where an American student was studying Farsi. Matt Trevithick had traveled to Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Israel, and he had lived in Afghanistan and Iraq. And in 2010, while visiting Iran as a tourist, he fell in love with the country and its culture and decided to return as a student. On December 7, 2015, he says he was grabbed off the street without reason and was taken to a prison in Tehran, where he spent the next 41 days. He says he became caught up in geopolitical forces. Now, Trevithick wrote about his experience in a piece for The Washington Post titled, "American Colleges Should Stop Recklessly Sending Students to Iran." In that piece, he argues that American universities are ignoring real threats that students face. But he also says his position is painful to promote because study abroad experiences had a transformative effect on his life. He wrote, quote, "Exchanges and related programs represent an important component of relations between countries, even those that can't find much to agree on. At one end of the spectrum, such initiatives model polite behavior between nations looking to impart a positive image, and at the other, they assist with the generation of informed and creative approaches to regional policy, authored by folks who have actually been there. In either case, they are invaluable for building trust in the community of nations," end quote. So in the midst of today's political and social climate, what are the security risks Americans may face when traveling to countries that are experiencing unrest? Are concerns like Trevithick's overblown? A new interactive travel risk map for 2019 shows Iran listed as low risk, just as safe as traveling to the UK. This hour, we discuss what we need to know about security when traveling abroad, and we'll discuss how local travelers and colleges and universities have adjusted their processes because of world tensions. I'd like to welcome our guests for the hour. Heidi Friedrich is here, who is a professional volunteer and a world traveler who helped spark this discussion, just returned from a recent trip to Iran. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Shaheen Manshapour, director of the International Culture and Arts Network and adjunct instructor of anthropology and sociology at RIT. Shaheen, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Also with us is Jane Gatewood, vice provost for global engagement at the University of Rochester. Jane, welcome back to you.
Thank you.
And welcome to Alan Ryan, Manager for International Travel and Security at the University of Rochester. Welcome.
Thank you.
This started with a conversation we had with a colleague who knows Heidi, and just a conversation about the recent trip. And so let's just start there. You were in Iran for how long, Heidi?
A little over 2 weeks.
And you were there when to when?
I just got back in October, late October. So.
Okay. And what did your family and friends say when you told them you were going to Iran?
You're crazy.
They did, huh?
Yes.
Okay, well, look, there's probably some genuine concern there, so let's talk about that. What was the purpose of the trip? You were going for what?
It was an art tour sponsored by the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. And I love the Middle East, and I've always wanted to go to Iran. And twice before I started to make plans and then got cold feet and because of people saying that. And this time I just said I'm doing it, and my children were not happy, but I'm very glad I did. I just had no fear of going there.
Okay. Now, apart from stereotypes someone may have about, you know, going to a place, a foreign place, were there specific concerns? Were they saying anything to you that did make you pause for a moment? What were they saying?
No, they think I do crazy things anyway. So this was one of the many. But no, nothing specific. They just, you know, people hear the word Iran and they think terrorist, I think, very often.
Shows you what, international propaganda can do. Okay, so what was your experience like there?
It was amazing. I'm just so glad I went. Everything was perfect. And I say to people, it's like going to Milwaukee. I mean, it was just, there was no fear anywhere. There was nothing. No one ever followed us. No one ever got on the bus. No one ever asked us questions.
I wonder if this is the first time Tehran has been compared to Milwaukee. but okay. Now, did you stay there? Where did you go?
We stayed in six different cities. We traveled from north, the Tabriz, which is near Turkey, all the way down to the southern part. And we visited many, many, many places. We were busy all day, every day. A lot of time on the bus, but beautiful scenery. Beautiful. It's a desert, but the mountains are incredibly beautiful. And the greenery everywhere. They developed these underground water systems thousands of years ago, which are still in use. And so in this desert, every city has trees and flowers, and it's just, there's such pride in their gardens, which in a desert was really beautiful to see.
You were there for 2 weeks, and you saw a countryside that had a lot of beauty. You saw, I'm sure, a lot of tremendous artwork and history, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yes, lots. So
what stood out most to you?
Oh, I think the museums were wonderful, and Tabriz, and all over, and the mosques, these beautiful mosques, the tiling, and the artwork, the things they were doing in the year 1000 just were incredible. So that was a big part of it. The beauty was all around us. The hotels were wonderful. I had a balcony looking out at this gorgeous garden one night for three nights, and everything. And the food is amazing.
Tell me about the food.
The food is great. Very, very good.
Shaheen wants to jump in. We'll get there, Shaheen. let's see what Heidi says.
I want to invite her over.
Tell me about
you guys too.
Tell me about the food that you experienced that you want to try to duplicate here.
I'm not cooking much these days. I have been invited to a Persian dinner recently, and it was wonderful. So it's a lot. There's a lot of meat. I don't usually eat meat, so I didn't, I mainly stayed with the vegetables. But the hors d'oeuvres are, the salad bar, is you're so full after that, you don't think you can eat another thing. And then they bring these big platters and of beautiful dishes. And the people were just incredible. I mean, they stopped us everywhere. The first day, these medical students stopped us, and all girls stopped us in the museum, and they just, "Are you from America?" "Yes." "And can we have our picture?" And everywhere we went, and I'm still emailing with people, that women that just came up to me in a park.
Iranian women.
Yes, and they keep writing to me, and they say, "Please send your friends here. Please give them my email. I will give them a beautiful trip." They don't really understand that it's hard for us to come. I had a wonderful massage in Tehran, and so that girl came back the next day, and we've been writing back and forth, and she said, "When are you coming back?" So the people were incredible. I mean, there was just nothing about the trip that gave me pause for concern ever.
Hmm. Now, sometimes, Heidi, when people travel, they go to sort of resort location. I admit, I don't understand why people do this, but I also don't want to judge. I mean, people have different experiences, different preferences. But, you'll talk to people who go, they say, "Well, I went to Costa Rica." Well, you interact with the Costa Rican people. "Well, we didn't see very many, and we stayed at a resort, and it was, a beach and a pool." And it does not at all sound like your experience 2 weeks in Iran was anything but experiencing the culture, experiencing the art and the history, and interacting quite a bit with the locals that you met, yeah?
Yes, we didn't get invited to their homes. And some of the people on my trip, there were only 14 of us, but a couple of people were upset that we didn't have more cultural exchange. But I said that you can understand why that is. We went to a wonderful contemporary art gallery. I bought an amazing painting by I think she's quite famous there, woman artist, who does a lot of work. Her art is showing the discrimination against women, bodies covered up with sheets, and just, she was beautiful. And she married her college art professor, mm-hmm. and they came to dinner with us afterwards, so we got to talk to her. And then there was a brand new museum of old musical instruments, and they performed for us, had a concert for us on these old instruments. So we just did so many things that we had a guide who was incredible, and he'd take us to buy rugs because he is building resorts along the Caspian Sea villas. So we had a lot of fun looking at these gorgeous silk rugs.
Did you change your family's mind, those who didn't want you to go?
I think as I started emailing every night, they were shocked, I think, that I could email from Iran.
Boy, people have interesting ideas about the rest of the world. Okay.
No, I think, they're not as interested in travel as I am, and maybe they just are not at the age yet, but I don't know. I think they were glad that I went.
Okay, and you think WXXI's Travel Club ought to consider Iran for a future trip?
I think so, but I think you must go with this company in New York that does it twice a year, and they know all the ways to get there, because we never got our visa till 1 week before we left, so we really didn't think we were going. And our guide didn't think that we would be coming.
Okay.
And he felt that we were maybe one of the last groups to get in because the sanctions are getting worse. There's no medicine and all of that. So.
All right. So, Shaheen, what do you make of what you're hearing from Heidi's story?
I hear from Heidi that she went with an open mind. And she didn't bring along a pair of dark glasses, metaphorically, through which to look at the people and everything that surrounded it. If she did, the first thing she would have noticed was the terrible traffic. What do you think about traffic?
It was bad.
It is very bad. So there are good things and bad things in every country. And in Iran, there are some things that are extremely bad and some things that are extremely good. So it depends on the traveler. The traveler is part of the travel experience.
Thank you.
And let me also, if you don't mind, Shaheen, ask you to respond to some of the comments we received from Iranian-American Zeri Kemere, who's been on this program before.
Yes.
I think alongside you. You know Zeri. And she had the following to say, making distinctions about travel to Iran specifically. She says, if people are not involved in politics, whether they are tourists, expats, or current residents of Iran, as long as they follow the rules, they usually have a very good experience traveling to Iran. Personally, I have never had trouble, but I always worry. There is a reason for these worries. And she references some recent news stories about that, which we'll get to. The Iranian people, she says, are different from the government. They are fun, warm, loving. They love guests. They go out of their way to be hospitable. The Iranian government, though, will find any reason to trap you that they will. And this is not a propaganda against them. They have shattered some lives, and I think they will continue to do so. Having said all of this, I am always keeping myself out of the politics of Iran, and I continue traveling to my birth country with a lot of fun, but I feel like a sheep. I am always quiet when my family and friends talk about the government of Iran. Can you tell me about your thoughts on Zeri's comments on the difference between the citizenry and the government?
Yes, definitely there is a difference there. And again, I want to say that we hear about these cases of being people being imprisoned in Iran and tortured, and lives have been lost by the Iranian regime. You have to understand that it's a regime that is in fear of outsiders and enemies who they think will oust them. And in their belief, there is foreign, whether it's true or not, the regime believes that there's a lot of Western money being spent in Iran through the intelligence services of United States and others who want to topple them. So therefore, they inspect a lot, and especially if someone, let's say, from United States goes there who has published a book with heavy criticism of the regime, or has served in the intelligence services of the United States, or served in the Defense Department, when they go to Iran, they shouldn't go to Iran. They should be not going to Iran if they know what happens. I go freely. I've been there many times. My husband, who's an American, and my daughter have been with me. I plan to go again this spring. I don't feel any fear because I'm not associated with any political activity directed at the regime. So I see all the, I go and experience the beautiful part. Still, like Zeri says, you feel a little bit afraid. Is it true because of all of these things? Can they just grab me because my husband or my daughter are attorneys? I don't know. It's still, I personally don't have any fear of going.
Now, have your feelings changed at all in the last couple of years with international travel bans? The current presidential administration has attempted to institute even wider bans, but has instituted certain bans. That has led to talk of reciprocity. Has that changed the feeling at all?
A little bit, because now from both sides, I'm a little bit afraid. There have been also Iranians who are Iranian-Americans who have gone there and have had trouble coming back to their families who are American citizens because of the travel ban and all the extra questions that they are asked. So at this side is Trump, at the other side is Khamenei, and sometimes hearing from both sides, you feel maybe this is not the best time to go.
Okay. Heidi, did you think about that at all, or did you essentially let the company planning the trip handle all of those questions?
Yes, everything. The only time I was asked, coming back into JFK, they didn't open my suitcase. I didn't go through any kind of whatever. I just handed my passport to the man, and he looked up at me and he said, "What would cause you to go to Iran?" And so I said, "You want to know?" And I started telling him how wonderful it was. And he sort of, you know, shook his head because he's working for the government. But I thought that was interesting that he was interested that why did I choose to go there? I guess he thought I was crazy too, maybe. But
well, look, I think there's some distinction between your family, who was maybe concerned about recent news items, administration travel bans and issues like that, compared to people who say, well, you know, who might have always been saying for a decade, well, travel to the Middle East is crazy. Travel mm-hmm. here is crazy. And there's nothing wrong with wanting to make sure that you understand the security situation. We all ought to do that everywhere we go. But I do think there is some sort of a tinge of stereotype mm-hmm. in some of what you hear. And do you think there's a difference, Heidi, between, again, that legitimate concern and planning versus, you know, well, going, you know, anywhere is crazy. There are some Americans who have never left this country and think that every other country just hunts and gathers. You know, it's just a different world. Do you think there's a difference?
I was surprised that once I made my reservation and said that I was going, I was amazed how many people, you know, just one person said, "That is like the 18th thing on my list to ever do." And sort of demeaning a little bit, you know, I made the choice. I figured it was my choice. And the people that I really listened to were the people who said, "That is fantastic. You wanted to do that for a long time. Mm-hmm. You're going to be fine. You're going to have a wonderful time." And they were the people that I had already respected a lot with their opinions about things.
Does it make you sad to hear the international relations in that the Iranian government talks about the United States and has for decades as the great Satan? In our country, mm-hmm. we talk about, you know, we tend to talk about Iran coupled with terrorism, fears of terrorism, as opposed to trying to look at a diverse citizenry that are, you know, almost entirely composed of people like anywhere around the world trying to raise families, go to school, be productive members of society. Does it make you sad to see that relationship?
Very sad. These people were just so nice, and I think I would love to send my friends there, you know, Yes, it does make me sad.
Well, let me ask Jane and Alan what they make of part of the op-ed from the Washington Post that I read. And that came about a year ago from Matt Trevithick, who, again, if you missed the story, he was someone who traveled extensively. Syria, Jordan, Israel, Lebanon, Afghanistan, fell in love with Iran, was going to school there, and was grabbed off the street and held for 41 days. And his contention is too dangerous right now. If you're a university or a college especially, you ought not be sending anyone to Iran. I'll start with Jane. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that it takes a one-size-fits-all approach, which I would steer clear of in evaluating any travel. So it always is going to be a constellation of things that an institution looks at, and one of those things is going to be its risk tolerance. But the other things are going to include the traveler, what they're doing, where they're going, what time of year it is, what does the health circumstance look like of the traveler and the country. There's a laundry list of things that do get considered that Alan can speak to in greater depth. But I would quibble with that that assertion that, you know, American colleges should stop sending to one particular place versus another. We always try to take a very nuanced and granular approach to any travel evaluation. And I will also say that the U.S. Department of State recently has become more granular in its own travel advisory system as well, that Alan can also speak to with greater depth if needed. But historically, the U.S. Department of State would label a particular country, you know, as a do not travel zone mm-hmm. across the board, border to border. And now the Department of State takes a more granular stance and looks at things by province and even by city and neighborhood to some degree.
Interesting. So you've got University of Rochester students in how many countries right now?
A number. Over 100.
Over 100. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, Alan, let's talk about how you sort of assess that security. As Jane said, you know, there's a lot I'm sure that your job entails in understanding the security situation. Let's take Iran as an example. If are there students in Iran from University of Rochester? No? Not currently. Okay. Is that a country that you would not advise, or how would you make that decision in terms of evaluation?
Sure. Well, as Jane said, we wouldn't take just a one-size-fits-all approach. We would. We currently have a high-risk travel review process in place. So when we identify that there's a student or a group of students or a faculty or staff member taking students or wishing to take students to one of these high-risk destinations or what we define as a high-risk destination, and Iran would fit into that category, we put them through this high-risk review process, and that really dives into all the itinerary-specific details, the backgrounds of the travelers, you know, what they're looking to do, and then we weigh that against the security environment in the country. So we identify the primary risks, you know, and we look at the kind of the vulnerabilities of the travelers as well. And we ultimately make a determination whether, as an institution, we want to sponsor or support that travel. So this is, you know, it's much different than advising, say, a traveler who personally wants to go. That's not something, you know, a space we get into because we're purely reviewing institutional travel and whether we want to, you know, sponsor or support that. So we do have that high risk travel process in place, and that's really, really important for any institution to do simply because you need to have something in place that looks at all those details. It doesn't just say, hey, you can go here, or no, you can't go there, because really there's a lot of itineraries that could be full of risks that you may not really understand or know until you dive into all those details.
Okay. I'll expand a little bit on the 2019 travel risk map launched by Global Risk Experts International SOS in collaboration with Control Risks. And here are the lists. They've got five categories: insignificant risk, low, medium, high, and extreme. And in the insignificant, you've got countries like Luxembourg, Denmark, Slovenia, Switzerland, Norway, Finland, Iceland, Greenland. In the low risk category, and you've got the UK and the majority of European countries, the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Iran, Jordan, Oman, Qatar, UAE, Kuwait, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Armenia, Uzbekistan. And in the extreme risk, it's almost exclusively in Africa and the Middle East: Syria, Yemen, Afghanistan, Libya, South Sudan, Somalia. So that's their assessment. And I think some might be. Shaheen, any surprise, by the way, that the UK and Iran are listed as the same in terms of
risk? I was just thinking about that.
You're surprised?
Yes. Then we have Middle East at the bottom of the list, at
the extreme
highest
risk. Yeah.
Risk. And Iran, by many people's standards, is, of course, part of the so-called Middle East. And yet Iran is separated and in line with England, not the rest of the Middle East.
Yeah, indeed. So when you work with students and staff who are going to various countries, Alan, what are the sort of the categories of planning? Cultural understanding, language, customs, you know, what are the things that you've got to work through with them?
So we definitely want them to thoroughly research their destination well in advance. And we really encourage and want them to look at reputable sources. You know, anyone can go online and find a number of sources that either support or don't support travel to certain areas. So we try to really first have them understand those specific risks from reputable sources. So one that we actually use, we contract an intelligence provider who they have a portal. Students can go in, access that information, and really understand those cultural norms, the specific security environment there, the health risks, what immunizations they should get. It kind of gives a good overview of every destination. And, you know, we also recommend the U.S. Department of State's website, as Jane mentioned. They did overhaul it this year, and it's much better than the old travel warning system, which was exactly what we said. You know, you should go or shouldn't go is what it kind of previously said. And now it gets a lot more granular, and it does give specific information about regions and cities. And they actually apply a 1 through 4 risk rating system, kind of similar to what you just talked about. So the State Department has their own. And anyone can go to their website at travel.state.gov and look that up. So currently Iran, you know, is a level 4, which is a do not travel rating. So, you know, it kind of contradicts the map that you're talking about,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But so in addition, back to your question, in addition to kind of the cultural norms and understanding those destination-specific risks, we like to look at everything from their methods of transportation, their accommodations, what kind of travel assistance providers are they using? That's a really, really important one. You know, like you said, having on-the-ground knowledge and having that organization and company have that expertise, that's really, really big. So we like to always see that travelers are partnering or using these providers. And that really helps for the response side. So we always like to see that there's some type of a response capability should something occur, some emergency, and that could be anything. It could be a security-related event. It could be a natural disaster. So having that provider and that insurance coverage in place is really, really important. And that's a big concern right now, actually, for Iran, because with the new or reimposed sanctions, it's really impacted, you know, of course, the economy, but it's led many organizations, including these travel assistance providers and insurers, to actually pull out or wind down their operations in Iran. So kind of that emergency assistance side is kind of lacking right now. And that's funny how you pull up the ISOS map, because they're one of those providers, I believe, right now that has significantly winded down their operation. So that may affect or impact that rating coming up. But so that's definitely a big issue as well.
Well, let me ask Jane and our other guests as well the same question that I want to turn to our listeners. When I opened the hour, Matt Trevithick's piece in the Washington Post was not only his call for the United States universities and colleges to stop sending students to Iran, but also his lament about that, because he says there's such a benefit to international travel to bridging cultural divides in different ways. And I want to ask our guests about that. And I want to ask our listeners what you might have experienced in travel abroad that stands out to you in terms of the benefit, maybe stereotypes or barriers that came down when you traveled, or do you find yourself in the category of saying, you know, that's it, this is not the time to be traveling abroad? 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. Jane Gatewood as Vice Provost for Global Engagement at the University of Rochester. Trevithick saying there's such a benefit to this kind of travel for students, for citizens. You've traveled yourself. I mean, how do you see that?
I agree with his point there. There is such a benefit. Nothing is going to be as effective and breaking down barriers as collaborative education, as cross-cultural education, and as traveling and visiting and learning with others.
Do you think students become, you know, ambassador is the wrong word, but you sort of kind of an ambassador for breaking down those misunderstandings or stereotypes, and when they return home, when they hear friends discussing, I mean, because you can't measure sort of the ripples, but there's got to be a lot of ripples here.
There are a lot of ripples. I think one of the a lot of times this gets talked about in very lofty terms and very abstract terms, but William Fulbright, you know, said very famously, this is not an abstraction. This has a very real pronounced effect, and it does. It's maybe not quantifiable in data terms that we like to imagine, but it does have very real effects. I think we're even seeing that here with Heidi sitting here saying, it was wonderful, and I would encourage anyone to go. That type of experience can break down barriers both within yourself and for your local community.
Heidi, what did you feel, changed for you as you, or maybe not, I mean, I don't know what your expectations were going to Iran, but what maybe either changed or helped you help others around you, whether it's family or friends, see Iran in the way that you do now since you've traveled there?
I don't know. It just felt so normal. I've traveled to so many places, and it the hotels were perfectly, everything was it's great. I don't know. And the people being so friendly. I mean, I haven't been in a lot of countries where people rush up to you and say, where are you from? And, you know, not knowing, because there are some European travel. There's not much travel going on there. We saw three other tour groups Australia, Germany, and Spain, I think. Because, well, now with the money situation the way it is, it's good for other people to go, you know, because everything is there. But I feel so bad for them. I mean, I came home with $6 because I was so glad to leave what I could there because they need the money so badly. So that made me feel sad, too. I mean, these people who are trying to make everything, make a living, and they just almost have nothing because their real was just dropped to nothing.
And understanding that I'm not trying to sort of wave away concerns about what Iranian regime has been responsible for and its behavior. But if you were to hear friends or family talk about Iran and the Iranian people in blanket terms, they all hate Americans. Mm-hmm. It's a dangerous place. It's a home of terrorism. No one should go there. How do you now think that you would join that conversation? Would you respond?
I think I would just say you
just started
true.
Laughing. You actually just started laughing.
Because it's so far from the truth to feel that way. I mean, from everyone I met, I didn't, you know, we had no government, obviously, interference. The guy that we had was very worldly. He's been to the States many times, and he's got his own business, and, you know, he knows a lot about what's going on. He did never, never, never talk about anything in the government or say anything. You know, we had to wear headscarves all the time. That was the only downside. I guess there was one downside, and that was wearing a scarf all the time. But then he'd say, well, okay, you could take them off when we're out in the country on the bus, you know, but then put them back on. So that was the only, like, political thing that we heard from him. The young girls are wearing their scarves way on the back of their head. I mean, they're almost falling off their head. So you do see the young folks are definitely challenging the regime in that way, that small way.
And Shaheen, how do you view the benefits of international travel?
I'm a beneficiary of that, and the fact that exactly 50 years ago, half a century ago, I came to Pittsford, Rochester as an exchange student, and it changed my life. And it changed my political views, even though I was 17. At that time, I had been raised in a family with a father who was constantly talking about Dr. Mossadegh and the democracy we lost because of American presence interfering in Iran, and there was a lot of hatred of American foreign policy, but love for Americans, on the other hand. And the year I came here, it sorted out everything, in my view, that people are different from governments, and foreign policies are not necessarily reflective of what people feel in a nation. And I think it's one pillar of knowledge and understanding is travel.
Well, I'm going to get our only break, and we're going to grab Andrew in Rochester on the phone. We'll take some of your emails as well as we talk about the benefits of international travel, the risks and the realities. You're hearing Shaheen Manchapour, who is the director of the International Culture and Arts Network and instructor of anthropology and sociology at RIT. Heidi Friedrich is someone who just returned from a trip to Iran, sharing her experiences, and from the University of Rochester, Jane Gatewood and Alan Ryan with us. Let's get that only break of the hour, and we're right back to your feedback next. Coming up in our second hour, a new documentary film called Back to Natural takes a look at the historical discrimination that African American people have felt here in the United States and people of African descent have faced around the world simply for wearing their hair in its natural form. We'll discuss it, the film showing on Friday evening at the Little Theater, and talk to the people behind it coming up next hour. Welcome back to Connections. Let me grab our first phone call. It's Andrew in Rochester. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I wanted to call in response to your question about experiences and study abroad. I'm a clinical professor today at the U of R. And 20 years ago, as a college student, I did a study abroad program for a half a year in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. So we arrived there in Dar es Salaam on August 7th, 1998, a few short hours after the U.S. Embassy had been bombed. If you remember the headlines from that summer, that's when the bombings happened in Nairobi, Kenya,
yeah,
in Dar es Salaam. It was a scary time. But the point of my call is that we spent a half a year there. It was wonderful, positive experience, despite all the chaos of being in the country at that time and not really sure what was going to proceed, and sort of highlighting the uncertainty when you go abroad. And you can never anticipate exactly what's going to happen, but that was such a life-changing and affirming experience. It changed my whole direction in life. I wound up going from an interest in science to an interest in clinical medicine, interacting with faculty abroad, and sort of realizing for myself that a career in academics was something that I aspired to. And so I find myself today where I am directly as a result of that great travel abroad experience, how it changed my horizons, changed my whole outlook on life. You know, and that went through that much trouble, but it was still such a positive experience. I've always tried to express that to folks, students coming behind me along the way, that you know, it's sort of an invaluable experience. And you can't predict the dangers that are there. Obviously, you have to take all the concerns into account, as your guests were describing earlier, but not to be underestimated. What a positive and great experience it can be.
And Andrea, let me just also ask you, given the political climate around the world right now, it just feels like so much is driven by fear. And I try not to say that dismissively or derisively, but it's just sort of an observation. Do you think that more travel, more exposure, more of this kind of cultural connection and bridge building is inevitably going to reduce the fear of the other that seems so ascendant right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's essential to create in our young people, but in our adults and in our seniors, this sort of awareness of others. Again, my family was terrified about where we were and what we were going on. But you know, the other point I would make is that can't anticipate how resilient young people can be. Me and the 19 or 20 or so other young people I was with during this trip, we didn't freak out. We didn't panic. We, again, partly because we were felt so secure amongst the local Tanzanians who were there, the university folks, they helped us and they supported us. That has reduced my fear, and throughout life, it's always made me open and adaptive and much more interested in welcoming the unknown, welcoming the foreign. I now find things that are unusual, strange, they're interesting and appealing, rather than sort of a more kind of closed-minded, only feeling comfortable in my own environment, only understanding and feeling comfortable about my own culture.
So, that is a really great distinction. What is different is interesting and intriguing and not something to engender fear. And so before I let you go, I mean, I don't know if you've got kids of your own. I keep thinking, Andrew, the way I see kids growing up, how overt, I think it's important to be overt with kids just about, you know, difference is beautiful. And to talk about, you will encounter difference and you will encounter cultures or ideas that you don't understand or languages you can't speak. And that is not something to mock or fear. And I think that maybe we don't give kids enough credit. We should not underestimate kids, even at young ages, ability to start understanding that and internalizing that. That's just my own sort of parenting view, and I'll get off the soapbox on that. How do you feel about that?
I would agree with you in that regard. I am a parent. I have three kids who are all young school age, coming up on their teenage years. And, you know, I naturally see them sort of a draw to, you know, what's popular, what's comfortable, what's familiar. We happen to have a multiracial family anyway, and so we talk about differences in diversity a lot. But you know, one of the things I've always emphasized, and I certainly understand people's concerns and cautions. I haven't traveled extensively with my kids, but I'm really looking forward to that, those coming teenage years that are just in front of us, where I really want to implement that into their lives, because I think it does. I think it drastically changes anyone's worldview. No matter what you think you know, the experience of being in another part of the world and experiencing a completely different people is going to change everything. It's going to change the way you see the world and the way you see yourself. So,
Andrew, thank you for sharing your experience and taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Andrew in Rochester. We're going to get to Teddy in Rochester next in a moment here. Jane Gatewood, Sounds like a University of Rochester professor. I saw a lot of smiles on your face during that phone call.
Definitely. You know, Andrew brought up a few of the many things that we point to that education abroad instills and helps build in people: adaptability, resilience, the ability to engage with and approach difference with respect. You know, one of the things that Alan always says in the office is adapt and overcome, and it's one of my favorite things about him. He spent considerable time abroad as well. And, you know, I think those are things that we all need more of.
When you say adapt and overcome, and Alan, you not only got a smile on your face, you had to be thinking that's exactly the phrase that Andrew was describing. You know, when you're all of a sudden you're on an abroad trip and you know, international crisis hits. But he said, even in that moment,
right,
you can adapt. There are locals who are really giving and generous. And did adapt and overcome, does that come to mind for you there?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm smiling because it's a common term in the Marine Corps. And I'm a former Marine. So, you know, the environment is always changing. And you really do. You just have to adapt and overcome. And when you're traveling abroad, you run into a lot of those same circumstances where you may have certain expectations, and those expectations may be completely different than the reality on the ground. So just having that attitude to adapt to a new environment is really, really important, just, you know, kind of for your own sanity when you travel, as well as just, you know, understanding the risks.
Shaheen, you want to add to what you heard from Andrew there?
I think he's right. It's adaptability increases with travel, and the more different things you see and get used to, the better you become at adapting.
Heidi?
Adapting to the toilets in Iran. It was difficult, and I never, well, it was, and we overcame it, but it was.
Adapt and overcome the toilets. I think I'm not going to ask a follow-up. I'm just going to go to the next phone call. This is Teddy in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Teddy.
Hi, Evan. Well, I remember spending a euro pretty much anywhere in Italy and France to get a toilet. So that's not surprising that things are a little different in the world. But I wanted to add in, there was a comment about people being emissaries. And I want to strongly agree that in my experience speaking with Parisians and Italians when I was in Rome and Paris, that would have the time to talk to me, and we would share a beer in both instances. You know, I wanted to know, what was the impression of the average American? And the average impression is that we're arrogant, we're boisterous, we don't ask questions or pay attention. And there are attitudes which reflect stereotypes of every group of people from every nation in the world visiting another nation. And I think that just is because they have their culture, and here's another culture moving in to, you know, maybe just observe it or not really do exchange at all, not being open. Mm-hmm. And I found that was regularly the impression of Americans, and I was sad to hear it. But there is this notion of not necessarily being open to new experiences. And it strikes me that it's important not only to be adaptable, but perhaps prepared, because I always felt a little strange not having spent some time developing a language before I went to the nation. I feel like it's important for someone who is new in a nation to bring some common understanding of values, and by showing one's willingness to attempt the language, you're demonstrating that. And that all renders down into my point, which is to say, everybody who is from another place is an emissary to the place mm-hmm. that they go.
Yeah, I mean, désolé, madame, je ne parle pas français. It's valuable to at least be able to tell people I can't do it. But Teddy, let me also ask you, you know, when you hear the stereotypes of Americans not open to experience, fair or unfair, overbroad, how do you feel about that?
Well, I have felt embarrassed to be an American standing next to people acting that way. On some of these trips, mm-hmm. and I've been maybe arrogantly in my mind, and I know that's one of those descriptors, but I've also felt like I was definitely not that. So mm-hmm. I know that there are different camps and different qualities of people, but I think that there's a tendency to walk into a situation expecting it to take care of you, which is a common American attitude, and I don't think that's shared by a lot of other nationalities in the world.
Hmm. Thank you, Teddy. I appreciate the phone call. Interesting stuff there. So, Shaheen, now as someone who's been here in the United States for 50 years, some of those generalizations, do you agree or disagree with what you've heard? Not necessarily. Teddy's just sharing what he's heard about.
Well, certainly there's some of that. I used to be a tour guide in Iran after that 1 year of exchange student in Pittsburgh Central High School. And I remember taking different tourists from different parts of the world around the city of Tehran and its monuments and places of interest. And there were jokes among us, the tour guides. I was one of the three female tour guides in the whole country. The jokes were when we were waiting for an American group, we were saying, oh, no, they're going to come and ask for all kinds of demands and things. And they kind of had attitudes at times compared to, let's say, Japanese tourists who were always very, very non-intrusive, non-demanding. There are stereotypes. But then on the other hand, I feel that here in the United States, I feel that so many Americans are so afraid of being labeled as non-understanding and making cultural faux pas that at the end of the day, they're not that important. Mm. So what if you do not do exactly things the way Iranians do? Still invite them or go to their house. And if you make a mistake, it's not a big deal. You know what I mean? We have that too. Did I say the wrong thing? Did I act the wrong way? Should I take my shoes off? Are you going to be offended if I say this? People don't really hate you if you make a faux pas.
If it's an honest mistake. If it's LeBron James putting his arm around Will and Kate. If it's Michelle Obama putting her arm around
exactly.
The Queen.
Exactly.
Okay, let's not, this is not an international incident here.
Right.
Well intended. Okay, I got you. It's a great point. Let me grab one more phone call. This is Michael in Irondequoit. Go ahead, Michael.
Yes, hi, Evan. And Al. I just wanted to comment about my daughter, first of all, she's only 26, and she's already worked in several countries in Europe, and she's now working in New Zealand. And I think the adaptability that she has gained from that travel and being really being on her own in some of those countries, and I think that she's been a good ambassador, I think, for the U.S., but I also think that she appreciates home also, home being several different places, not, you know, Cleveland and Rochester and Columbus, Ohio. And so I think that adaptability and the appreciation it gives you for home. And I think she'll be coming back because I think she does miss that having that, you know, that not just safety in that, but just having friends around, you know, friends that you've known for a long time. But I think she has gained so much by traveling. It's just, she's just a different person, and she's grown in the last couple of years just immensely.
Well, Michael, thank you, and we wish her well. It's a great story. I think it puts a nice little point on the conversation we've had. Alan, probably no surprise there that adaptability mindset serves you well. And here he is talking about his daughter saying, you know, she's going to have a great life. She may move home to where she grew up. She may not. She's making friends around the world,
right?
Probably because of that adaptability mindset.
Right, right, certainly.
And Jane, do you hear stories like that at U of R, probably, from students with some frequency?
Absolutely. And we also hear, you know, often from employers, many of the things that they're looking for are, you know, ability to be resilient, to have critical thinking, problem solving skills, to be adaptable, to have that resilience. And I think also to Teddy's point, to be prepared. To come in with some again, that being a self-starter, I think. And travel teaches you a lot of that. If you're, again, you have to be open to it, but I think if you're willing to open, you know, it'll be there.
Heidi, do you speak any Farsi?
No.
Didn't pick up much along the way there?
No, I can't even remember. Good morning. I'm sorry to say.
Shaheen, how many languages?
I speak just Persian, English at this point, and sign language I can do. I learned here. And in Iran, I learned several dialects because we are a diverse country.
Absolutely. Well, some final thoughts here from Heidi, about 20 seconds as we get wrapped. You're the reason we came here. We heard about your trip, and we thought it was so interesting. What do you think you benefited most from this trip, Heidi?
I think it, it's confirmed my belief. I'm sorry. It's confirmed my belief that a lack of fear is a wonderful thing to have. My yoga teacher used to say that I didn't get up in inversions because I was fearful, but then I jumped out of a plane. And then he said, okay, I can't pick on Heidi anymore because she jumped out of a plane. And it can't be fear. So I just think I'm so thankful to have that feeling of no fear.
It's almost like we're in the new version of Defending Your Life, one of my favorite movies, where they literally judge your life based on whether you lived it controlled by fear. Mm. And if you didn't, you get to move on in the universe. And if not, you have to come back.
We all come back.
Heidi, thank you. Thanks for sharing your experience. Shaheen, nice to see you as always.
Thank you very much.
And Alan and Jane from the University of Rochester, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, short break. More connections coming up.